Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
review of a telemovie, 8 episodes. I only ever watched one of it because I've written it off. Name of the Rose. The Name of the Rose. Now, absolutely awful, sort of disappointing on many aspects of it. And it's something which I've got high expectations of, because it's an area of history that people have sort of not picked up the right. They've sort of projected their present into the past, but the past is very much different. And this is Renaissance Italy around 1320. And the sheer implosion of intellect that was around there, which is sort of like a scrambling which led to modern science. So it is at one point amazing, it's one point bizarre, but it's the bizarreness which allowed Newton and modern science to evolve, whereas that bizarreness is still sort of embedded in other cultures. I want to say, it's sort of like it's the Middle Ages we had to have. It's like Australia, we had a Prime Minister saying, that's the recession we have to have. And so Australia went into a recession. So, I didn't mean it, but it was the Middle Ages we had to have. And let's talk a little bit about it. If you can imagine the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was an ancient empire, and suspicion reigned rife. So if a rock fell, or a tree fell, or a lamb just fell over dead, there'd be people. There wasn't Twitter or anything, madness to gossip. That gossip about just the most, a branch would fall, or there'd be some sort of thing in the sun, and that related in this really confused way. So it was, in essence, a very confused society, but it also meant that certain things had power, symbols had power, temples had power. It was confused, but sort of worked in a Roman sort of way. And that this, so you had the Roman Empire, the franchise, the instability, the ability to work things out without doing things. I find it very interesting to read the Roman philosophers, because a lot of them to me read like people who are writing Hallmark cards. They're very banal, they're very practical, very amazing, very insightful, but not uplifting, or not deep insight. So insight into human nature or relations, but not deep insight into the nature of thought. Well, that's just my overall view. So into this, you have you've got this culture, and it compresses over and over again. Different things are happening to it all the time. This is mainly the Vandals and other cultures coming in and weighing lace to it. So it contracts up into these little abbeys, which is this here, which are Roman households. And so the Christianity and these abbeys come together and get distilled into these abbeys, because the abbey and the households are the only defensible place. So they'd go around, laid siege, laid waste everything. They'd live rudely, so to speak. And so they weren't very much interested in these tall structures. They was sort of outside their view. They had an idea of amassing hills of bounty. Into this is, we're talking a few hundred years before Name of the Rose. You had this, the Byzantine Empire collapsing, the Roman Empire collapsing, and people, picking their conquerors and sort of infiltrating their conquerors in a certain way, but as they infiltrated one band of conquerors, the next band of conquerors were competing with them, so they couldn't infiltrate too far. And so they did this fantastic manoeuvre of going to Britain and Ireland, and then basic religious movement went down and swept and sort of gutted Europe from the north. So you have these English, you have the Italians, but you also have these English converts coming down and doing these great things, playing mind games with the Saxons and stuff like that, really confusing them. And part of out of the confusion, they basically trick Charlemagne and various people into giving the Holy Roman Empire, it's sort of a trade-off. They sort of, by removing the god there, they say, well, now we have the god here, and before that they had a mystical connection which gave them power, but sort of a democratic type of power. This is amazing. They used to elect their kings in Teutonic times, so you'd be king for a while and go across. And the hereditary, it was a much more fluid place. And so as they knocked up one power, it sort of lurched this thing forward. Now, given that this, it was an ancient, vastly, I think, sort of like stupid, terrifying thing in terms of, like one of the dumbest things of human nature is actually to select, to decide things by compact. Trial by combat, trial by torture. They would essentially say, who's got the biggest dick? Well, let's have a big battle over it. And if it wasn't that aspect, it would be some other aspect. And if you look at, say, the way ideas were fought and stuff like that. So you have this coming through, and you've got this sort of quintessential 830, sort of very early, it's sort of just coming out of the Roman Empire. They're just working out the Byzantine, Constantinople isn't what they really want, and a little bit of confusion. And then you've got the deep confusion of having your power through the church, so the power is coming through. And so you've got Pope Formosa, who didn't back the right person. It has Bulgarian, you go Bulgarian missionaries. The church is divided between two, or not between two, and this competition. People at this stage are sampling churches, saying which one will provide me greatest power over my people. That basically, I can have a church which is much lower cost than an army standing over every bloody village giving me grain. So the church had this thing about, well, here you got to pay your tithe, you pay so much to the church and so much to the state, i.e. that the church was acting for the state. It was complex power, really winding back the entire good work of Diocletian, who was 500-400 AD. Diocletian, great emperor, got a filthy murderer, completely. He was sort of like a Donald Trump of his time, but with brains, incredibly savvy, and Diocletian, I think he was so good because he really wasn't morally connected to his time. So he was able to be as a consultant, sort of an arm's length consultant. He was a Serbian emperor, and so he wasn't really wound up so much in the history. He could come in as a consultant and cut across, he would drain the swamp, so to speak. This is Diocletian. So you got this Formosa. The interesting thing about Formosa is that they wanted to get a different decision. So it came down, invaded Rome, didn't sack it, but then they had to dig him up, try him for making a bad decision. The dead corpse, which was rotting in the chair, was found guilty. They then smashed the papal ring. So there's these various things that you've got the papal seal. This is, it's almost like Bitcoin. Things have to be traceable to the seals and stuff like that. And, of course, there's forgeries and, it was an insane time. What I was going to say is that the donation of Diocletian, which is the donation of Constantine? Did I say donation of Diocletian? Diocletian would have donated anything to Constantine. They had this paper, and it was forged, and it said they showed it to Charlemagne's dad or grandfather, I think. And the Frankish armies came down and said, oh, well, look, it says that you own all this land, and so it's giving us legal legitimately, and it says you can have this and we can have that. And we've got this complex things where you can call us emperor due to this document here. And the document was fraudulent. So you had this sort of break with the ancient past. So they lost the ancients because they didn't know about it. So this is where we go across. So we've got Formosa, the Pope, coming up. You've got Anastasius, the librarian, anti-Pope. You've got a whole lot of different popes running through the place. And then you've got, fast forward so many centuries, this is now stabilised in. You've got a few more saints going through, St. Francis. You've got St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, I wonder if St. Thomas Aquinas was Franciscan. So you've got the Augustine. Now, Augustine are these elements of ancient thought. So Augustine thought is really ancient. It's to do with rhetoric. Which is a really ancient thing, that you can actually convince someone by talking to them. And then and you also got to understand at this time, from 800 to 1300, at a point there, people began to read and read to themselves. So 800, around that time, people still couldn't read silently. They could only read aloud. So this is why you have eavesdroppers in the medieval time, because someone could get a sheet of paper, secret orders, open the map, shit, I hope no one's here, I'll go here, and up in the eaves will be someone who's listening, and you read it, and you can turn out the candlelight, and it says, kill everybody in such and such a village. Oh, I hope no one heard me reading that, because the idea of silent reading wasn't about. So St. Augustine and the last elements of the Roman Empire and that idea of rhetoric. So he's a very august speaker. Now, when you actually go back into the history, St. Augustus had his heavies there, and so hecklers were just chucked out, and people were applauded him, and he could speak in such a way, and he was a great novelist, and he wrote basically the first sort of autobiographical blog. It's the first blogger, St. Augustine, you come across, and it's only when you read it and try and interpret it, you realise that certain things that are conspicuous by its absence, and this is the ability for people to think to themselves. So well, you've got these ancient people basically coming out of the mud of Europe, just coming on, and they haven't got the ability to think silently. They must utter everything they think. So it's like the invention of lying, this type of thing, the great confusion. Now, if you can imagine, you can't think to yourself, or that the average person can't think to yourself. As you go up ranks, people eventually get the ability to think for themselves and read silently, but it hasn't gone down there. These people can be easily, if they're just not, they're really not educated. And so around the time of the Name of the Rose, you have the library. And so it's sort of like, I've got this thesis, I'm going to put it into a story, this writer. So he has this great library. And there were great libraries of books. Now, The interesting thing is that a lot of times if you read into these books which people were transcribing, they're complete rubbish. What is it? Letters to Livonicus. Very highly quoted stuff. Decided, well, let's have a look. This is really highly copied throughout the Middle Ages. And a lot of it is just used to transcribe junk mail, basically, because they didn't understand it, they didn't have context to it. There was sort of a reverence to it. There was a feeling that you really wanted it. You know, there's no printing press. You really wanted people driven. Can you imagine if today, you know, you weren't fed all that well and it was all confusing out there and you had a book and you had to write a page after page after page going through. So it is really good that people became motivated to, religiously motivated to do it. But it didn't mean they really understood what they were writing. So letters to Livonicus, a lot of the writing was transcribed without understanding. A lot of the writing was lost. And so this is a bit confusing. This is where this goes downhill really quickly. So 1300, 800, Britain doesn't have the Norman invasions. The Vikings get up. 1066, you get the Norman invasions of this church, very ancient, ancient stuff. And it's sort of like a little bit of a counter invasion happening up there. Italy, you have actually Norman forts. So if you go to Naples, you'll see a Norman fort. So it's very ancient stuff. So 1300 is 300 years, we're looking at 250 years after the Norman invasion and stuff like that. Europe's just at the dawn of its renaissance, but you've got these popes, and the pope is it's like this web of deception. There's a web of deception of the popes on the kings on their people, and people within the church on the pope, and no one can think logically, or logically as we would say. And so it would be very obvious, like, there's a lot of people exploiting this. So people would put down a tool, say they had some tools, farm tools, or one would go missing, and basically if the chief decided I'm going to steal it, he would be able to say, oh look, a ghost took it. This is just for instance. And people would go, I don't know whether this is correct. Yeah, so back again after a very microscopic base where my kids walked out to tennis and gave me a death stare. How dare you podcast and ignore us. Okay, getting back onto it. It was sort of like an enforced ignorance, and it's not the first time there's an enforced ignorance. That if anyone, people were making a lot of money out of ignorance, i.e. the king was king of an ignorant state, and if you got too smart from your boots, you got the chop. And so for this, you've got these things of the books and the idea that of this author from 1980, I think 1980, and we got a decent rendition of Name of the Rose with Sean Connery. She was doing a beautiful, beautiful rendition, and in that, I think it was, the book was written sufficiently, it was sufficiently produced sufficiently soon after the book, with sufficient constraints that you had to cut everything out and get the actual nature of the book correct. And of course, this doesn't happen here, but you've got the idea that people can't think logically, and so you have the idea, well, what if we have this Franciscan who is my modern, you know, the Franciscan friar in here who's the detective, is applying modern reasoning. Now So you've got the idea of applying modern reasoning in this completely mad world. You've got perhaps, I disagree with the book, that you've got this library and people are really interpreting and reading and monitoring what they've written. I think that's part of the point. One of the things is that the Inquisition is... The Inquisition and Scholasticism goes together. So Scholasticism is a quality control of the text. So you look at any piece of text and you blockchain it back to God, basically. And if it's not, it's out. You don't have to get rid of it. It's just that if people start to use that, you then have to do quality control outside of that. And so back, you know, fast forward another 250 years, the Inquisition have people at the borders and at the exit and entrance of the cities. They stop the carts. Have you got any books? Let me have a look. Books. I look through the books. These people, they don't have computers. They don't have laptops. But they do have margin notes. So they look for the margin notes to see anything, and then word of mouth, the Inquisitions go off. But the Inquisitions were not necessarily, they're more administrative warning. That it's not everything wound up in a murder, you know, in a flame. So this is where you go, you have that, this Franciscan person was an inquisitor. And in the movie, and I think in the book, He had to flame everybody, which is, of course, they didn't, and they used intellect. And so this is true, but it was not necessarily a something really special about them. That's what the church had, different grades of Inquisition. When the Inquisition was involved in church, in political power, like the Spanish Inquisition, that was very high up. Or there's one or two papal Inquisitions where the Pope wasn't in control, so you tend to get disproportionate ramping up of Inquisitions with a lot of murder and blah blah blah. But in essence, what they were interested in is taking on a situation, and they weren't killing anyone, wasn't going to do anything. You had to actually paint the response, sort of like marketing and PR and sort of bizarre thing. Yes, he has. Yep. Thank you. Okay, so there's people going off to tennis. So you've got this. So this idea of the Inquisition was a bit fluff. And then the idea of sexuality going into this world. Very in the 86 film, it was at the very, there was a woman in the background a little bit, and at the end there was this ingress of sexuality, having sex at the whatever it is, and then it was sort of like a phenomena that it's sort of a reflective phenomena that the Sean Connery says, oh, that's interesting, what was it like in terms of it's sort of very subtle here, whereas the sex in the movie was in your face. Every scene, there was great women actors and stuff like that. But the idea, look, the entire subtlety of that is gone. The entire subtlety of Inquisition has gone, and that in the film you didn't pick that up. I think I watched it in Narrow the Rose 30 years ago, so something along those lines. So that my memory's not all that good on it. But here you've got something coming on, and it's now 8 hours long, and it's now going across, and obviously, from then to now, a lot more study. And knowing that the Roman households had a dual layer of morality. They had morality for the slaves, morality for the householders. Different different morality, different system, different power relationship, the power inversion. The same thing happened with the abbots. The abbots lived a totally different life from their order. And so this wasn't shown here. You had the abbot being elected as the librarian. That's a mechanism. It's something that we would see, that you rise to the top of your corporation. But it didn't happen that way. That there was a noble class, and the nobles could appoint abbots, and so the abbots were nobility, and they didn't live the entire structure. There's that tension there, totally gone. So that's, yeah, I don't know whether it's a failing of the book. Of course, very interesting, very interesting in terms of being able to say, what if I had a modern mind, what would a modern mind look like? So a modern mind you put into this Franciscan, and this Franciscan friar then starts to make calculations. He says, it couldn't have been this. People are believing that. And so it was interesting in terms of that a lot of the power came, your ability to direct stupid minds, and people coming across, and the abbots of understanding. This is not the abbot, the Franciscan friar. Understanding, this was very interesting to see that that unfold, that he could see that, and this is where him not knowing about sex and stuff like that sort of distance him as a sort of a literary device placed into history as a literary machine, whereas it's not simply he also knew about sex and also knew about logic, he would be just one of us, and it would be a what if. So this is where the intrigue goes, and this is where it's sort of very hard to swallow. So he was able to say things have a cause and probability, and like this. One of the interesting things is that probability theory, even the theory before probability theory didn't come along. So there's these things from that period. They've discovered dice and cards, and their understanding of probability wasn't there. So if you had two explanations, one was not probable and one was very probable, but the fact that you just put the two side by side, you'd say, well, they're equally 50%, because that's my second argument. And you can also see that in Aquinas's Summa Theologica, he will come up with 10 arguments, generally 10 arguments about something, and some of them would be a bit woofy, and they wouldn't be stronger or weaker. You'd just eliminate them all. So it was a sort of very simplistic way of thinking. And you can see that a modern mind would come in and say, well, this murder comes across. You've got the end bit of the monk in the library, who goes in the library, the illustration of the library, and is involved and is reading something, you're not quite sure. You're given a lot more information to keep you watching for the next 8 hours or 7 hours. Good God, as if I'd do that. And they go through, and we're not quite sure what he goes, but the next morning he's hanging upside down in pig's blood and the pig, stuff like that. Except the pig, killing of the pig, is you've got a pig there, so you know it's pig's blood, and there's a reference to it before, and this is in the main square of their stuff. So you've got their church, which to go into, but also in this area is this trough pig blood's in, and just It's obviously a camera shot, so you can see the people running up. You can see the church in the background. It's all structured, sort of almost like a cartoon to come across. And you sort of say, how long would they leave pig's blood out overnight? And a pig overnight, hanging upside down, just the incredible. For me, on many aspects, it says to me that if your entire thesis is that people are now logical and they were illogical now, you can't. It's like the worst thing to actually have a scrambled, illogically, poorly structured thing and set that up as the gold standard, which the people within the environment can't see, because you're then sitting in a room of other people who can't see. I'll just quickly say how I ran this before I go off. This is 30 minutes. I wanted to see Navarth Rays for a number of reasons, having read it. Seen it in the gym sort of description, and it sort of got me into certain things. The way they constructed the trailer got me thinking in terms of the way that we have a sort of a comic way of constructing with CGI and camera movements. We have now got more a less UI view, more omnipotent. I was interested in that aspect, so I wanted to see it. No longer on Netflix, probably not a good sign, apparently. Then finding a DVD of it, then having had the DVD of it, saying, oh, can I see it? No, I'm going out to see it with my friends. Okay, I'll call all my friends over to see it. So I've called all my friends, or a few friends who'd come along, and I put them all in the same room, and I think, oh, this is a bit of an experiment. Will they kill each other, or what will happen? And of course, yes, not quite aspect of that, but you know, they don't always think to that they're going to be assessed. I don't know. So they threw them. So I watched it, and I tried to like it. I tried not to analyze it. I definitely didn't analyze it while I was reading with them. I didn't actually. Something which is limping along, I didn't destroy it in front of them, but the more I did, well, one is life's too short, but then again, I'm also thinking for, 25 years? Well, 35 years, 80, yeah, 35 years since the last Nav of the Rose written, and what has happened? There doesn't seem to be all that logic in it. So, I'll see you later.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.